this episode, we discuss all things gestational diabetes. This is a two-part episode as there was just so much we had to talk about. So we start with gestational diabetes in pregnancy, and the next episode we'll be looking at it from the mother and baby perspective. Listen in as Rachel gives us the most wonderful analogy about insulin and glucose, all wrapped up in the form of Pac-Man, and Rachel dissects some of the research to give us a greater understanding of the testing in pregnancy and what this all really means when a mother is diagnosed with gestational diabetes. We hope that you're enjoying all of our episodes, and we thoroughly enjoy the feedback you're giving us. And if you want to support the podcast further, you can hop on over to our new Patreon page, the link's in the show notes, and on our Instagram page. This is a cracker of an episode, and we'll be back with the second part very soon. So, go on, get your luggles ready, because here we go. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. So, Rachel, we are here today to discuss, I believe this is another one of your favourite topics.
I hate it.
Why do we do this podcast? What are we doing to ourselves, really?
We need to get more interesting people on who can talk about the hard stuff.
Ah, totally agree. Doors are open, peeps. Let's just go back to the beginning. What is gestational diabetes? And how is this different from, say, type 1 or type 2 diabetes?
Okay. So I wrote a blog post on gestational diabetes because it does my head in. And I find once it gets to things that you can't see with the naked eye, I find it really complicated. So bear with me.
So it'll be the same with me as well.
This is why we were like, oh, we're gonna have to do gestational diabetes.
We've put this off for so long because both of us are like, oh god.
Okay, so any diabetes is about insufficient insulin production to clear up the blood sugar. So I think of it as a Pac-Man game.
Yep.
So Pac-Man is the insulin. And I don't know what those little pills were that Pac-Man was eating. Let's just say they're sugar pills.
They were lollies. They were candies.
Right. So it's insufficient Pac-Men or Pac-Mans or women's to eat up the glucose. That's what diabetes is. So you get
such a brilliant analogy.
So you have lots of those little round pill things on your computer or whatever it was that we used to play it on.
Yeah.
So there's different causes, though, of that. So type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune condition. So that often happens early on in life. And it's where the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas are destroyed. So you don't make Pac-Men. So then you have insulin to make that up. And then there's type 2 diabetes, which is, you know, if you watch the news or the health reports, everybody's very excited because everybody's got type 2 diabetes when they're old.
Yeah.
We all have it. We're all fat, old, and have heart disease and diabetes.
Yeah, that's it. So it's going to kill us all.
It is. And that one's caused by either the body becoming resistant to insulin, so the Pac-Men don't work very well, or they don't produce enough insulin, so then there's not enough Pac-Men. So that's type 2 diabetes. So gestational diabetes happens in pregnancy, caused by pregnancy. So it's the placenta sends out the hormones from the placenta at around 20 weeks actually create insulin resistance in the mother's cells, because that's part of pregnancy. It's a normal physiological response to be insulin resistant. So then what the mother's pancreas does is it increases the insulin production to compensate for that. So she sends out more Pac-Men to make up for the fact that her cells are not really responding to Pac-Men and they're not letting them eat them as well. This whole Pac-Man thing is just like...
It's good. Go with the Pac-Man theme. It makes perfect sense. I was racking my brains to try and come up with an analogy.
All right.
I'm loving this. Pac-Man and insulin and the candy pills are the sugar, the glucose.
Okay. So in pregnancy, if there isn't that increase in insulin production, then you've got too much blood glucose, too much sugar floating around because it's not getting eaten up. And then that resolves once the placenta's out because those hormones are withdrawn and everything goes back to normal. However, sometimes what's called gestational diabetes is actually type 2 diabetes that hasn't been picked up until pregnancy because not many of us go around having diabetes.
Diabetes.
Oh my God. Diabetes tests. So does that explain what insulin, what diabetes is?
Well done. It bloody does. Absolutely.
You know.
Great. That is
next.
It.
Next. What's the next hard question?
Well, how do we test for it? Because, and if we, are we specifically going to talk about gestational diabetes
yes.
here? We're taking away the type 2 or the pre-diabetes that you just mentioned and the type 1. We're getting that off the table mostly. We're just talking about gestational diabetes in this context. How do we test for it? And from that, you know I'm going to ask you some questions.
I know. And we'll come back to type 1 because there are some issues around that in type 2, but we'll focus on gestational.
Sure.
So how we test for it is, well, there's two approaches to testing. So there's universal screening where every woman in pregnancy is offered a test. And then there's risk factor based screening. So I know when I was in the UK, probably when you were there, like gestational diabetes was pretty rare. We didn't often get women with it because we only tested for it if they were at risk of it. So
Absolutely.
Had a family history, had other health issues that would predispose that. But in Australia, and perhaps now in the UK, not sure, it's just every woman gets tested.
Yep.
So that's the approach to testing. There isn't any evidence to support either method of testing improve outcomes. So Cochrane Review looked at whether you do universal or just, you know, risk-based and found no difference in the outcomes. So,
wow, this sounds similar to what I'm going to talk about with the baby as well. When we find
Imagine that.
The whole scenario from mother to baby. We don't fully know.
So the usual test now that's offered in pregnancy, because it used to be the glucose challenge test. That's like not in fashion anymore.
Oh, God, yes. I'd forgotten
about
that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's not in fashion anymore.
No, I know.
It might still be happening in the US, but it's not happening anywhere.
Because we would do a challenge first and then you would go for a GTT, which you're about to talk about.
Yes. So now we just go straight to the oral glucose tolerance test, OGTT.
Oh, sorry. Now it's oral in front of it, not just glucose tolerance test. Okay.
And it's offered between 24 and 28 weeks, which makes sense because that's when the placenta would be doing its thing and send, you know, messing with a Pac-Man. Or earlier, if women are considered at risk. So that might be offered sooner than that if women are considered to be at risk, which is interesting, right, which we'll come back to.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the glycated hemoglobin. Don't know how to say that.
This is why we hate this topic. There are so many words that we can't say, and they're really complex.
So as an offside, my Why Induction Matters book is being recorded at the moment, not by me because I haven't got time.
I'm sorry, you didn't employ me and my amazing voice.
No, and there's a good reason I didn't, Katie, because the poor woman who's having to talk, like speak my words, is contacting me and saying, how do you pronounce like ridiculous word? And
well, at least I know.
I don't know.
Oh, okay. would I know? I'd know what they meant, though.
Yeah, exactly. I can write it with a bit of a spell test. Anyway, so the glycated hemoglobin test basically gives a reading of like what's happened over the 2 to 3 month period preceding the test. So that really only picks up women who already have maybe type 2 diabetes who didn't know they had it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's the same with if you're doing the oral glucose tolerance test, at, say, 14 weeks, you're not going to pick up gestational diabetes. You're going to pick up type 2 undiagnosed because the pregnancy changes haven't happened yet. So that's how you, oh, there's another way of testing that's not widely known, but women do it, which is self-testing, which is where women will just, you know, over a day or a couple of days, just test their own blood glucose levels fasting and after a meal. So that's another option that's often not shared with women. So that's how you can test for it, if it exists.
Right. Okay. So then when you're saying if it exists, where are the problems with that in terms of, you know, what rabbit hole are you leading me down?
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
Well, Michelle O'Donn referred to it, now I probably get this completely wrong, referred to it as a diagnosis waiting for a label waiting for a diagnosis.
A diagnosis waiting for a label.
No.
Nope.
We'll have to find that and put it in the show notes. Otherwise, we'll be inundated with everybody telling us what it is, because...
Send it to Rachel, not me.
It's a famous quote and I can't remember exactly what...
It sounds like it would be brilliant. That's...
It would be brilliant. But what it actually means... And what he meant was that we don't even... It's not even necessarily a thing, right? It's a thing we've created by... Yeah. Putting parameters, etc., around, you know, findings,
yeah,
and then created this problem that we then try and fix. And there's just debate over whether or not it's a actual thing, because it's physiologically normal for us to get insulin resistant during pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, and you know, certain women are more likely to get diagnosed, because I see that's one of your questions.
Thanks for answering it before I got there. That's great. I'm
keeping you on track.
My eyes just glanced.
And so are there certain women who are more likely to get gestational diabetes?
Well, that's doing my voice.
Women who were tested. No, basically, it's the same risk factors as type 2. So, you know, any pre-existing conditions, etc. Women who are diagnosed with gestational diabetes are often then told that there are increased chance of health problems later on in life.
Yes.
So cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes.
Scary
stuff.
So
maybe what's happening in pregnancy is that it's giving women a glimpse into their general health and their ability to meet challenges, particularly around insulin production. So rather than it causing the ill health, abnormal blood glucose levels might actually reflect underlying ill health. So it might
it's
be
a
that
signpost.
It might be, yes. But then we get into the controversies of
Yeah, testing, because this is a huge controversy of the testing. And, you know, I hear this talked about a lot, and I think it's something we definitely need to touch on here.
Yeah, and it kind of does my head in, because whether or not a woman has gestational diabetes will depend on where she lives and what tests she has and the parameters of the test that she has. So the incidence ranges from 2% to 26% around the world, depending on how we're testing.
That's not what I was reading as well. What?
So if we look at the parameters, right, they've changed. So this is probably why when we were in the UK as midwives, like, it was really rare to get a woman who had gestational diabetes. In fact, it was like a big deal. It's like, oh God, I don't know what to do. Like, ooh, incident. Oh my God.
Yeah. And then in labor, oh God, get the protocol out and I need it in the room so I can remember what to go through.
Yeah, it was like,
I can remember having that open, the book, because it was all printed at that point.
Well, since the olden days, the standard for gestational diabetes has changed. So if you're in a setting where they're doing a universal approach and everyone's offered it, and they're using the new parameters, then we've got 18% of women being diagnosed with gestational diabetes.
What?
Because the parameters changed because of a study called the HAPO study. Don't ask me what that stands for. You can find it on my website and click.
I will not ask her. She might tell me off.
And what it found was that, oh, surprise, surprise, the higher the blood glucose levels in pregnancy, the more likely you were to have a bigger baby. So it's all around big babies, right?
Yeah.
So then they decided to set the threshold for blood glucose values at where the odds of a big baby became 1.75 times higher. So just kind of pick that. Mm-hmm. So previously, so if you're not pregnant, do you know what your normal blood glucose levels are, Katie?
What, me personally sitting here right now? No. Yep. Of course not. I'm not testing. Or what they should be, or what I am currently, because I'm not psychic.
What the normal parameters are if you're not pregnant.
I've forgotten. It's like under 9, like between 4 and 9.
So
nursing. I never did nursing. And why did you put this on the podcast? You look really stupid now. I'm totally editing that. Also, it's really early in the morning and my alarm didn't go off, so I'm in a little bit of a shock and I've not had my cup of tea yet. Whatever. So I'm using that as my excuse. And my blood sugar levels are very low right now.
So if they are fasting, right, they have to be under 7 millimoles a litre.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I did know that.
Can I not say millimoles a litre? Can I just start saying 7 and you know what I mean? Because
yeah, I'm going to do that later as well. So that's good.
Okay, good. And then 2 hours after, it would be like 11. I think it's 11 that you're allowed. So that's the parameters, right? Is 7 is anything 7 or over is too high.
When you've eaten.
Yeah. No, that's eaten. Before you've eaten. Before you've eaten.
Before you've eaten. Over before, 7 is too high. After you've eaten, 11 is the top limit.
Yeah, I think the top limit is 11.
So right now I think I'm sitting on about 3. Good brain function for this.
Right. Well, so am I, because I've not had my cake this afternoon.
Yeah, all right. But you've eaten the rest of the day. I've been sleeping.
I've been sugar. Anyway, so the HAPO study found that the size of the baby is dose related. So then the International Association of Diabetes and Pregnancy Study Group.
Yeah.
That's a long word. I won't say that one again. That group decided to set the levels of, for a pregnant woman, we're now looking at or greater than 5.1 is too high, like pre-food, fasting. And then after you've eaten, 2 hours after you've eaten, then anything over 8.5.
So why have we reduced the limits for when you're pregnant compared to when you're just not pregnant?
That's a good question. Because you have 1.75 times the chance of having a big baby if your blood glucose levels are above 5.1.
And then what is considered a big baby? Now, I'm asking this because I know this question's going to come in. And how can we tell that there's a big baby?
So those thresholds have been shown to reduce the rates of babies over 4 kilograms. However, there is no evidence that it reduces the rate of birth or newborn complications. Whole thing is about making babies smaller, and a 4 kilo baby is considered big, which is interesting because like my experience is most babies are 4 kilos or over, certainly in the population of women who have home birth in Australia.
Wow, that's really interesting.
So that's the threshold that we're going with at the moment, which puts 18% of women as having gestational diabetes if they get tested.
When did that threshold change? Because it never used to be that restrictive.
No, I think it was around 2014, 2015. Mm-hmm. There was an Australian study by Cade et al. In 2019, looking back at the data from their hospital. And they found that the new criteria had increased the incidence of gestational diabetes, not surprise, increased massively the overall cost of care.
Absolutely.
And had made no obvious change in short-term outcomes.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. From that paper, has anything changed? Or has another study been looking at retrospectively to say, yep, we're also finding the same here in different countries? This is clearly not an advisable guideline.
Not that I know of, but there is basically no good evidence to support testing women and labeling them and then managing a pregnancy because a woman's blood glucose levels are over 5.1 millimoles a litre.
Yeah.
But that's what we're doing. So what we're seeing is huge numbers of women being diagnosed as gestational diabetes. And then that takes us into your next question, Katie. What's the management?
Yes. I mean, at least you're telling the viewers that I wrote the questions. So that makes me...
to keep me on track. So once a woman has the label, which all that describes is that for her, she's not keeping the pack men, churning them out at a level that keeps the sugar pills at a level that's been made up, that's very low and a lot lower than she would have to do if she wasn't pregnant. So once she's had that label attached, she is now high risk. And the whole focus is managing her naughty, naughty lifestyle to get down her.
She might have a naughty lifestyle and be eating too much chocolate.
Lots of cake.
Oh, a nice Australian cake.
Either by diet or by insulin.
Yes.
And then she will. When you talk to women who've gone through this, they experience a lot of shaming. They'll often get referred to what they call the fatty clinic. I have heard, women call it that, where they have to sit around with other women and talk about, the fact that they're overweight and that they've got diabetes and how can they. So it
has a lot of stigma, fear and restrictions attached to it, and also like the amount of visits you have to go to. It's not just now with the midwife, if you were having midwife-led care. It's now with the doctor, the midwife, the dietitian, depending on how your care goes. And then which are the women who are going to be put into the diet camp? That's not the right word. Which are going to be...
Take your tent over there.
You're in the diet camp. You can't go home. You've got to stay here. You need insulin now. When are our thresholds for that? Is it when women are not, or when it's considered that the blood sugars are not stable? And so by recording those and being monitored, they're seeing that these blood sugars are not stable. And that's when we have this initiation of insulin.
Yeah. So the whole focus is to keep the blood glucose level. It's under the threshold, which is 5.1. So that's the focus. And if the woman isn't able to do that herself, which a lot of women are not going to be able to, because they're probably sit around six maybe when they're not pregnant, and that they're not able to do that, that then the insulin will be introduced in as a way of managing. So it's all about managing blood glucose levels, which is interesting because if her blood glucose levels remain within a normal range, right, she has no additional risk factors to any other woman in terms of her birth or her baby, none. And yet she's still managed as if she's high risk. So she'll be offered a routine induction, even though, you know, there's no chance, there's no increased chance of anything happening. She'll be offered that routine induction just because she's got the label.
Yes.
And even though guidelines, so we've got guidelines, including the World Health Organization, saying that if a woman has been diagnosed with gestational diabetes and has maintained normal blood glucose levels, she should not be induced for gestational diabetes because she's not going to have a bigger baby if you think that's a problem, which it's not necessarily a problem. But if you think the big baby's a problem, if her blood glucose levels are normal, then she's not going to have a bigger baby because of blood glucose levels. So why are you inducing her for that?
Yeah. And okay, so then it comes to the point of how are we defining big babies in terms of, is it accurate? You know where I'm leading you with this question. How will we define it? What is considered big? And how accurate is the scans that we use?
Well, the scans aren't accurate. You can't tell the size of a baby from a scan. That's got good evidence to support that statement. We keep doing it, but we can't actually tell. So we can't tell that there's a big baby based on a scan. So big babies are 4 kilos or over. That's what's considered big. Women now, and this is part of the problems. We haven't done a podcast on big babies, have we? Might have, can't remember. Part of the problem is that when research is done into groups of women who have big babies, then they include women who have had big babies because of blood glucose levels and women who just have big babies because that's what they grow.
Genetically,
Genetically big babies. And there is a difference because if you have high blood glucose levels in your pregnancy, then lots more sugar pills are getting through to the baby. So the baby ramps up their Pac-Men. So the baby has more Pac-Men to capture all of that insulin and turn it into fat. And where the baby stores the fat is different to just a big baby. So they tend to store it up around the shoulders and they look like little rugby players. It's all up the top end.
Yeah.
And those babies are more likely to have shoulder dystocias, for women to have perineal tearing. They're still more likely than not for that not to happen, but there's an increased chance because you've got a bigger baby with bigger shoulders coming through the pelvis, which then calls into question why we're not then trying to promote and support things that improve outcomes like instinctive birth and movement. And instead we go, oh, well, we'll actually manage this for you. And one of the things we'll do is induce, even though induction increases the chance of shoulder dystocias, because it rams the baby through the pelvis before the baby's done the things.
Yeah.
So we're
and increases the chance that she can't move, increases the chance she needs epidural, increases the chance of cesarean, postpartum hemorrhage. So all of those things, and increases the chance that she's just going to be lying there on her back because induction is tends to be more painful, harder for the woman to go through. And then we've just, it's like a misnomer. It's like this whole backwards situation of how you would support a woman who had possibly a larger baby on board.
Yeah. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You say, oh, you've got a big baby. Yeah. That's dangerous. We'll do all these things. And then you actually cause the complications that you then save the woman from and say, see, it's because you had a big baby. Big babies are dangerous.
And what does that do for the next baby that she has and for all of the friends that she then talks to?
Yeah.
We know what happens.
Yeah. So we know that abnormal blood glucose levels, i.e. actual high ones, will create bigger babies that are differently shaped and increase the chance of complications. So, you know, my idea is that those women should then be supported even more to promote physiology.
Yeah.
Because then you're going to have better outcomes. So that's one thing it does. There is this whole, you see stillbirth mentioned as a risk factor for gestational diabetes.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that because it's everywhere.
Yeah, it is. So I
looked, and it's a scary thing to read.
Of course it is. And then women are more likely to say, yes, induce me. And
absolutely.
So I went scrabbling about to find where that came from when I wrote Why Induction Matters, because that is actually what I had been taught and what I believed as well. So that idea comes from research that was done on like looking at gestational diabetes, but it included women who had type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes. So the difference is that if you have high blood glucose levels in early pregnancy, because at 20 weeks, the fetus is fully grown and it's just getting bigger. So any high blood glucose levels interfere with the growth of the baby or change the growth of the baby. If you have high blood glucose levels from preconception in particular, through very, very early fetal development, then it increases the chance of congenital abnormalities.
Yes.
Miscarriage and stillbirth. So when you combine all diabetic women into a big group, which is what the studies used to do, then you'll find a higher chance of stillbirth.
Of course.
However, when you pull all those out, it's associated with type 2 diabetes that wasn't diagnosed. So the woman didn't know she had high blood glucose levels, or poorly managed type 1 diabetes. Mm-hmm. The recent studies looking at type 1 diabetes is actually really reassuring, because it's managed so well now in well-resourced countries that stillbirth rate is gone. So for a woman who has type 1 diabetes who, you know, is engaging with whatever treatment she's on and managing that from preconception through, then her chance of stillbirth is no greater than a woman who doesn't have type 1 diabetes. So that stillbirth risk is like a artifact, I guess, from previous studies that isn't really still supported by evidence.
Wow. Thank you for clearing that up. Because if you go searching anywhere on the internet, whether it's, you're going to see that. Absolutely. And particularly about the congenital abnormalities, that's also important, because when, even when you look for gestational diabetes information, that will be there as well. And that's really nicely cleared up. Excellent.
Yeah. And the other questionable thing is that transition. So the increased chance of respiratory distress for babies who have got mothers who were diagnosed with gestational diabetes. And it's really difficult to work out whether that's a thing, as in that the insulin's interfering with surfactant or something's happening like physiologically in the lungs, or it's because we're inducing these babies before they're ready, so they're struggling to transition.
Absolutely. And we're much more likely to be doing that. And particularly if it's before 37 weeks, which we know. You know, even without diabetes, we know there's more of a risk factor for respiratory distress in these infants.
So basically, what that leaves us with is, in terms of the birth, is a bigger baby, which, you know.
And can I just ask, and we've probably covered this before, but I just want to backtrack in terms of when you say the scans are not accurate, how inaccurate are they?
I could find that for you. You'll have to pause the recording.
That's all right. I knew you'd have this answer. And I think it's really important for us to mention this, because we get asked this a lot.
All right. So 15% either way of their actual weight. So for example, if a baby's actual weight, this is what I wrote, is 8 pounds. That's the UK speakings.
What's that in kilos? Didn't you do both? What's wrong with you?
I didn't
woman?
Actually for this bit. I just did pounds and ounces.
We've worked
back to the olden days.
Oh, olden days.
So I don't know what.
You must have been quoting the research.
Or maybe I was trying to translate it and then got completely confuzzled and just thought I'll just stick to pounds. That's good.
8 pounds is about 3.7 kilos, isn't it?
Is it? Anyway, if the baby is estimated to be 8 pounds on ultrasound, it could be anywhere between 6 pounds 13 and 9 pounds 3.
That's a vast difference.
Yeah, because you can't estimate
6 pounds 13 under 3 kilos.
Right, so
2.9 kilos. Short, so it's actually quite a little baby.
Yeah, so you can't estimate the size of a baby. So you stop doing that. And if we're worried about the size of the baby in terms of it being too small and that is then about growth restriction, because you're not worried about a genetically small baby. What you're worried about is that the placenta is not feeding the baby. So scanning for the size of the baby doesn't help with that. You need to actually scan and look at what the placenta is doing. So let's stop scanning babies to guess at their size.
Where I am at the moment in this part of the world, it seems routine to not even palpate a mum at all. And they scan at every visit. They don't even touch the belly. They just scan, which is, I was gobsmacked when I got here. But anyway, I'm sure that's happening in lots of countries.
I'm sure it is. And of course, nobody's doing any further research into ultrasound scans because we don't want to find that out.
Yeah, exactly. Let's not go down that route. That could be another podcast with someone who knows much more about it than us.
Yes, let's do that. So now, Katie, you're taking over because the baby's been born.
Yes.
This is your department.
It is my department. And this is... Oof.
Yep. So I hope you did your revision because here are the questions.
This feels like Mastermind. And now for your 10 questions. Clock is on.
Apart from you cheated and wrote the questions.
I was just trying to think what people would like to know. All right. Come on.
All right, Katie, are you ready? First question.
I'm really nervous now.
What effect can gestational diabetes have on the baby after birth?
That wasn't the first question. Now I've got to look through my notes. It's because I'm looking at your notes. Bollocks. Piss off. I'm cutting that. Because I should know this. We hope you enjoyed this episode. We'll be back very soon, don't worry, with part two. So hold on to your ... fill in the blank here as you choose. I started a new slot here at the end of last episode, where I wanted to take the opportunity to say thank you for all those utterly wonderful comments you are putting all over Apple iTunes and Apple Podcasts. And so I want to read out the occasional one or two just to let you know that we are listening and we are reading. And thank you. Have we mentioned you yet? This one's from, I think, Mikachu. And Mikachu says, essential listening for all women and birth workers. Have listened to every episode, sometimes more than once, like to hear that, and have found insightful wisdom in every one, not to mention the entertainment value in listening to Katie and Rachel, which is like being a fly on the wall as two old friends drink and cackle at each other's private jokes. That sounds like us. And this one's from Old Modwife. Fantastic, funny, and informative. I was given a recommendation from a midwife colleague to listen to this podcast, and it is now one of my favourite ones to listen to. Topics are covered in such an authentic and engaging way. I have learnt, laughed, and cried in listening to their podcasts. Please keep them coming. She did actually write weekly podcasts, but clearly, as you guys know, we don't quite get round to weekly podcasts yet. Until we're ultra famous and being paid for it. So hopefully that will come about soon. Thanks for being with us in the cauldron and for all of your support. For more information and to keep up to date, follow us, of course, on Instagram at The Midwife's Cauldron, and you can follow Rachel at Midwife Thinking. And of course, as always, I'll leave you with our bloopers.
Ooh, what the shit?
She's never occurred before.
Where'd she come from?
Dunno. This meeting is being recorded. I don't like that. I can't be sneaky and record you.
It says, look, hang on. By continuing to be in this meeting, you are consenting to be recorded.
Has it never asked you that before?
No.
So I have to get rid of all the podcasts because you've never consented.
Yep.
Sorry, listeners. They are going. That's it. This is the only one that's going to be there. We've built up all those numbers.
Do I click continue then?
Yeah, that would be good.
There you go.
Hooray! It doesn't say anything to me. I hoped... that she would come back and go, Rachel Reed has consented. Because that's obviously how she sounded. Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, the Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough at times quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created the Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.